Confucius alone has had as great an influence. Everybody knows how, at Alexandria and in Imperial Rome, the work of Aristotle became the foundation of advancing science. How in the 13th century his philosophical writings, brought by the invading Moors to reawaken Europe, played a fertilizing role in the development of scholastic philosophy. How the great summae of that virile age were only adaptations of the metaphysics and the Organon. How Dante placed Aristotle first among all thinkers, quote, master of those who know, close quote. How Constantinople brought the last lost treasures of his thought to the eager students of the Renaissance. And how this quiet sovereignty of one man over a millennium of intellectual history came to an end only with the audacious irreverence of Occam and Ramus, the experimental science of Roger Bacon, and the innovating philosophy of Francis Bacon. We shall not find again, in this tour of the world upon which we are engaged, another name that so long inspired and enthralled the minds of men. Number 4. St. Thomas Aquinas. So, Greece flits by, and we come to Rome. Who are the great thinkers there? Lucretius, first and finest of all, yet, because his philosophy was not his own, but with modest candor was ascribed to Epicurus, and because his influence upon his own people and upon posterity was esoteric and sporadic, touching only the topmost minds, we shall have to let him stand outside our circle, consoled with his high place in the literature of the world. And as to Seneca and Epictetus and Aurelius, they too were echoes of the Greeks, adapters of Zeno's apathy to a dying Rome. The old civilization was disappearing as they wrote. The strength had gone from the sinews of its people. Freemen were everywhere replaced with slaves, and the proud free cities of the past were humbled with vassalage and tribute. The master class divided into wastrel Epicureans or Spartan Stoics, too militantly stern to indulge in the delights of philosophy. Suddenly, the ancient edifice collapsed, and European civilization lay in ruins. It began again when the Church healed the strife of factions with the mystic authority of the Word and brought men back from the battlefields to a settled life. The emperors passed, the popes remained. The legions marched no longer, but the monks and missionaries of the rising faith created quietly a new order in which thought could grow once more. How long and dreary was that second adolescence of the conscious European mind! Even today we are so precariously established in enlightenment that we can yet feel, as if in memory, the fearful groping of those many years. And then trade grew. Towns graduated into cities, schools into universities. Again, it was possible for some portion of mankind to be freed from toil for the leisure and luxury of thought. Abelard stirred half a continent with his eloquence. Bonaventure and Anselm laid down in majestic theology the rationale of medieval faith. When the work of preparation was complete, another Aristotle came, St. Thomas of Aquino, a man who took the universe for his specialty and flung a frail bridge of reason across the chasms between knowledge and belief. What Dante did to the hopes and fears of the Catholic Renaissance, Aquinas did for its thought, unifying knowledge, interpreting it, and focusing it all upon the great problems of life and death. The world does not follow him now, preferring a doubting Thomas to a dogmatic one. But there was a time when every intellect honored the angelic doctor, and every philosophy took his gigantic summae as its premises. Even today, in 100 universities and 1,000 colleges, his thought is reverenced as still sounder than science, and his philosophy is the official system of the most powerful church in Christendom. We may not love him as we have loved the rebels and the martyrs of philosophy, but because of his modest supremacy in a great century, and his vast influence upon millions and millions of mankind, we must make a place for him in our litany of thought. No doubt some hearts will break at this selection, including the author's own. There are so many other names that one might here invoke more lovingly than Thomas's, names far more congenial to the modern world, names like Spinoza or Nietzsche, for which one may have passionate affection rather than mere intellectual respect. But if we prove unfaithful to the standards we have ourselves laid down, we may as well abandon our quest at once. Our list would then be an album of favorites, rather than a gallery of great minds. Number 5. Copernicus. And then came a voice out of Poland, saying that this earth, footstool of God and home of his redeeming pilgrimage, was a minor satellite of a minor sun. It seems so simple a thing to say. We cannot be moved to fear or wonder by it now. We take it for granted that this soil on which we stand is a passing thing, transiently compact developments that will disintegrate and leave not a rack behind. But to the medieval world, whose whole philosophy had rested on the neighborly nearness of Earth and God, on the constant moral solicitude of the deity for man. This new astronomy was an atheistic blasphemy, a ruthless blow that seemed to overthrow the Jacob's ladder which faith had built between angels and men. Copernicus's book, On the Revolutions of the Celestial Orbs, was well named, for no book in history has created a greater revolution. That pious Polish monk, sitting patiently before the baffling stars, had meant no harm. He had no suspicion of the bearings of his thought on the future of belief. He had lost himself in the search for knowledge. He was sure that all truth must be good and beautiful, and would make men free. And so, by the magic of his mathematics, he transformed a geocentric and anthropocentric universe, a world that revolved about the Earth and man, into a kaleidoscope of planets and stars, in which the Earth seemed but a moment's precipitation of a floating nebula. Everything was changed, distances, significances, destinies. And God, who had been closer than hands and feet, who had seemed to inhabit the friendly and flowing clouds, disappeared into the far reaches of an illimitable space. It was as if the walls of a man's house had been torn down by some blind and angry wind, leaving him unsheltered in the darkness of infinity. We do not know how profound a thinker Copernicus was, except through this immeasurable influence of his work. With him, modernity begins. With him, secularism begins. With him, reason makes its French Revolution against a faith immemorially enthroned, and man commences his long effort to rebuild, with thought, the shattered palace of his dreams. Heaven becomes mere sky and space and nothingness, or it descends upon the earth and breeds visions of utopia in the hungry hearts of men who had once hoped for paradise. It was, as in the fable Plato told, of the gods who had cared for man till he had come of age, and then had disappeared, leaving him to the devices of his own intelligence. It was as in the ancient savage days when the old man of the tribe drove the young men forth and bade them seek some other soil and raise upon it their own homes and their own happiness. With the Copernican Revolution, man was compelled to become of age. Number 6. Sir Francis Bacon. He did not falter at this sudden maturity. On the contrary, the century that followed Copernicus was one of youthful audacity and courage in every field. Little vessels began to explore the now round and limited earth. Frail minds began to explore the intellectual globe, careless of dogma, unharassed by tradition, and never dreaming that mankind would fail. Oh, the zest of those bright Renaissance days, when the poverty of 1,000 years was almost forgotten, and the labor of 1,000 years had made men richer and bolder, scornful of barriers and bounds. The flash of those alert eyes, the rich blood in those strong frames, the warm color of their luxurious raiment, the spontaneous poetry of that impassioned speech, the creative, insatiable desires, the search and sweep and fearlessness of newly liberated minds. Shall we ever know such days again? Whom can we name as voice and symbol of that fermenting age? Leonardo? Painter, musician, sculptor, etcher, architect, anatomist, physiologist, physicist, inventor, engineer, chemist, astronomer, geologist, zoologist, botanist, geographer, mathematician, and philosopher. Alas, our definitions and criteria exclude him. He was he not, an artist primarily, and only secondarily a philosopher or a scientist. It is by his Last Supper and his Mona Lisa that we remember him, and not by his theory of fossils, or his anticipation of Harvey, or his majestic vision of universal and everlasting law. Or shall it be Giordano Bruno, that forever-seeking soul, unsatisfied with the finite, hungry for an immeasurable unity, impatient of division, sects, dogmas, and creeds? Only less controllable than the winter's winds, only less fiery than Etna, and doomed by his own turbulent spirit to a martyr's death? No, it cannot be Bruno, for there was one greater than he. The man who rang the bell that called the wits together, who sent out a challenge to all the lovers and servants of truth everywhere to bind themselves together in the new order and ministry of science, who proclaimed the mission of thought as no vain scholastic dispute, no empty academic speculation, but the inductive inquiry into nature's laws, the resolute extension of the mastery of man over the conditions of his life, the man who mapped out as with royal authority the unconquered fields of research, pointed 100 sciences to their tasks, and foretold their unbelievable victories, who inspired the Royal Society of Great Britain and the great Encyclopedia France, who turned men from knowledge as meditation to knowledge as remolding power, who despised worship and longed for control, who overthrew the Aristotelian logic of unobservant reason and turned the gaze of science to the self-revealing face of nature, who carried in his brave soul, beyond any other man of that spacious age, the full spirit and purpose of the modern mind. Of course, it was Francis Bacon. Number 7. Sir Isaac Newton. From that day to ours, the history of the European intellect has been predominantly the progress of the Baconian, as against the medieval, conception of the world. Predominantly, but not continuously, there are many great figures that stood aside from this main road. In Descartes, the new struggles in the arms of the old and never quite liberates itself. In the great unifying soul of Leibniz, the medieval tradition is still powerful enough to turn a mathematician into a precarious theologian. And in Immanuel Kant, the voice of ancestral faith speaks amid the skepticism of the Enlightenment. Strangely bridging these two streams of thought, the scientific and the religious, stands the figure of Spinoza, polisher of lenses, and God-intoxicated man, silent devotee of lonely speculation, and formulator of the metaphysics of modern science, lover of mechanics and geometry, and martyr equally with Bruno to philosophy, dying only a slower and obscurer death. Every profound mind after him has felt his power. Every historian has attested the quiet depth of his wisdom, but we have bound ourselves to judge these heroes of the mind in objective terms of influence rather than by personal estimates of wisdom, and even a lover of Spinoza must confess that the healing touch of the, quote, gentle philosopher, close quote, has fallen upon the rare and loftier souls rather than upon the masses or even the classes of mankind. He belongs to the islanded aristocracy of thought, and the world has not mounted to him yet. But of Sir Isaac Newton, there can be no similar dispute. Quote, every schoolboy knows, close quote, the story of his absent-minded genius. How the great scientist left for a moment to his own culinary wits and told to boil an egg 3 minutes for his lunch, dropped his watch into the water, and watched the egg while the timepiece boiled. Or how the absorbed mathematician, going up to his room to change his clothes for dinner, undressed and went contentedly to bed. It would be sad if these delightful stories were not true. Not so many schoolboys know that Newton's Principia marked the quiet assumption by science of its now unchallenged mastery over modern thought. That the laws of motion and mechanics, as established by Newton, became the basis of all later practical advance. Of that recorded surface of the earth, and that extended and intenser life, which are the miracles of science in our day. The discovery of gravitation illuminated the whole world of astronomy, and brought the bright confusion of the stars into an almost organic unity. Quote, not long ago, close quote, said Voltaire, quote, a distinguished company were discussing the trite and frivolous question, close quote. Alas, this is an untimely quotation. Quote, who was the greatest man? Caesar, Alexander, Tamerlane, or Cromwell? Someone answered that without doubt it was Isaac Newton, and rightly. For it is to him who masters our minds by the force of truth, and not to those who enslave them by violence, that we owe our reverence. Close quote. Even in his lifetime, the world understood that Newton belonged to its heroes. Number 8. Voltaire. It was Voltaire who introduced to France the mechanics of Newton and the psychology of Locke, and thereby began the great age of the Enlightenment. It will shock scholastic minds to see Voltaire included among the supreme thinkers of mankind. They will protest that his thought was borrowed rather than original, and that his influence was immoral and destructive. But which of us is original, except in form? What idea can we conceive today that has not enjoyed in one garb or another a hoary antiquity of time? It is easier to be original in error than in truth, for every truth displaces 1,000 falsehoods. An honest philosopher will admit, like Santayana, that truth in its outlines is as old as Aristotle, and that all we need do today is to inform and vary the design with our transient needs. Did not Spinoza, profoundest of modern thinkers, take the essentials of his thought from Bruno, Maimonides, and Descartes? Did not Ramus defend, as his thesis for the doctorate, the modest proposition that everything in Aristotle is false, except that which he pilfered from Plato? And did not Plato, like Shakespeare, borrow lavishly from every store, making the stolen goods his own by transforming them with beauty? Granted that Voltaire, like Bacon, quote, lighted his candle at every man's torch, close quote, it remains that he made the torch burn so brightly that it enlightened all mankind. Things came to him dull, and he made them radiant. Things came to him obscure, and he cleansed and scoured them with clarity. Things came to him in useless scholastic dress, and he clothed them in such language that the whole world could understand and profit from them. Never did one man teach so many, or with such irresistible artistry. Was his influence destructive? Who shall say? Shall we abandon here the objectivity of judgment we proudly assumed, and reject the laughing philosopher of Fernie because his thought was different from our own? But here we have sacrificed Spinoza, though some of us swear by his philosophy, sacrificed him because his influence has been, though deep, too narrowly confined. Evidently we must ask of Voltaire, not do we accept his conclusions, but did the world accept them? Did his thinking mold the educated humanity of his age and his posterity? It did. There can be little doubt of it. Louis XVI, seeing in his temple prison the works of Voltaire and Rousseau, said, quote, "Those two men have destroyed France," close quote, meaning despotism. Perhaps the poor king did philosophy too much honor. Doubtless economic causes underlay the intellectual uprising that centered in Voltaire. But just as physiological decay leads to no action unless it sends its message of pain to consciousness, so the economic and political corruption of Bourbon France might have proceeded to utter national disintegration, had not 100 virile pens brought home the state of affairs to the conscience and consciousness of their country. And in that great task, Voltaire was commander-in-chief. All the rest willingly acknowledged his lead, and did his bidding proudly. Even the mighty Frederick greeted him as, quote, "the finest genius that the ages have borne," close quote. Beneath the recrudescence of ancient beliefs amid which we live, the influence of Voltaire quietly persists. As all Europe in his century bowed to the scepter of his pen, so the great leaders of the mind in later centuries have honored him as the fountainhead of intellectual enlightenment in our time. Nietzsche dedicated one of his books to him and drank deeply at the Voltairean spring. Anatole France formed his thought, his wit, and his style on the 99 volumes which the great sage left behind him. And Brandeis, aged survivor of many a battle in the War of Liberation, gives some of his dying years to a forgivably idolatrous biography of the great emancipator of Fernie. When we forget to honor Voltaire, we shall be unworthy of freedom. Number 9. Immanuel Kant. Nevertheless, there was another side to this irrepressible conflict between simple faith and honest doubt. Something remained to be said for the creeds which the Enlightenment had apparently destroyed. Voltaire himself had retained a sincere belief in a personal deity, and had raised, quote, "to God," close quote, a pretty chapel at Fernie. But his followers had gone beyond him, and when he died, materialism had pursued every rival philosophy from the field. Now there are two modes of approach to an analysis of the world. We may begin with matter, and then we shall be forced to deduce from it all the mystery of mind, or we may begin with the mind, and then we shall be forced to look upon matter as merely a bundle of sensations. For how can we know matter except through our senses? And what is it then for us but our idea of it? Matter, as known to us, is but a form of mind. When Berkeley, for the first time, clearly announced this novel conclusion to the world, it made a stir among the pundits. And it seemed to offer a splendid exit from the infidelity of the Enlightenment. Here was a chance to reassert the primacy of mind, to reduce its threatening enemy to a mere province in its realm, and so to restore the philosophical basis of religious belief and immortal hope. The supreme figure in this idealistic development was Immanuel Kant, perfect archetype of the abstract philosopher. Kant, who traveled much in Königsberg, and from its promenaded streets saw the starry heavens melt into a half-unreal phenomenon, transfigured by perception into a subjective thing. It was Kant who labored best to rescue mind from matter, who argued so irrefutably, because so unintelligibly, against the uses of pure reason, and who, by the prestidigitation of his thought, brought back to life, magician-wise, the dear beliefs of the ancient faith. The world heard him gladly, for it felt that it could live by faith alone, and did not love a science that merely darkened its aspirations and destroyed its hopes. Throughout the 19th century, the influence of Kant grew, time and again. When rationalism and skepticism threatened the old citadels, men fled for strength and refuge back to Kant. Even so, matter-of-fact a man as Schopenhauer, and rabid a heretic as Nietzsche, accepted him, and looked upon his reduction of the world to mere appearance as the indispensable preliminary of every possible philosophy. So vital was Kant's work that in its outlines and its bases it remains to our own day unshaken and intact. Has not science itself, through Pearson, Mach, and Poincaré, admitted that all reality, all matter, all nature, with its laws, are but constructs of the mind, possibly, but never certainly known in their own elusive truth? Apparently, Kant had won the battle against materialism and atheism, and the world could hope again. Number 10. Charles Darwin. And then Darwin came, and the war waged anew. We cannot know now what Darwin's work may finally mean in the history of mankind, but it may well be that, for posterity, his name will stand as a turning point in the intellectual development of our Western civilization. If Darwin was wrong, the world may forget him, as it has almost forgotten Democritus and Anaxagoras. If he was right, men will have to date from 1859, the beginning of modern thought. For what did Darwin do but offer, quietly and with a disarming humility, a world picture totally different from that which had contended the mind of man before? We had supposed that it was a world of order, moving under divine guidance and omnipotent intelligence to a just and perfect fulfillment in which every virtue would find at last its fit reward. But Darwin, without attacking any creed, described what he had seen. Suddenly the world turned red, and nature, which had been so fair in the autumn's colors under the setting sun, seemed to be only a scene of slaughter and strife, in which birth was an accident, and only death a certainty. Nature became natural selection. That is, a struggle for existence, and not for existence merely, but for mates and power, a ruthless elimination of the unfit, of the tenderer flowers, the gentler animals, and the kindlier men. The surface of the earth seethed with warring species and competing individuals. Every organism was the prey of some larger beast. Every life was lived at the expense of some other life. Great natural catastrophes came. Ice ages, earthquakes, tornadoes, droughts, pestilences, famines, wars. Millions and millions of living things were weeded out, were quickly or slowly killed. Some species and some individuals survived for a little while. This was evolution. This was nature. This was reality. Copernicus had reduced the earth to a speck among melting clouds. Darwin reduced man to an animal fighting for his transitory mastery of the globe. Man was no longer the son of God, he was the son of strife, and his wars made the fiercest brutes ashamed of their amateur cruelty. The human race was no longer the favored creation of a benevolent deity, it was a species of ape, which the fortunes of variation and selection had raised to a precarious dignity, and which in its turn was destined to be surpassed and to disappear. Man was not immortal. He was condemned to death from the hour of his birth. Imagine the strain upon minds brought up in the tender philosophy of our youth and forced to adapt themselves to the harsh and bloody picture of a Darwinian world. Is it any wonder that the old faith fought fiercely for its life? That for a generation, quote, the conflict between religion and science, close quote, was bitterer than at any time since Galileo retracted and Bruno burned at the stake. And do not the victors, exhausted by the contest, sit sadly today amid the ruins, secretly mourning their triumph, secretly yearning for the old world which their victory has destroyed? Apologies. Well, there are our 10. Shall we see them in one glance? Number 1, Confucius. Number 2, Plato. Number 3, Aristotle. Number 4, St. Thomas Aquinas. Number 5, Copernicus. Number 6, Sir Francis Bacon. Number 7, Sir Isaac Newton. Number 8, Voltaire. Number 9, Immanuel Kant. Number 10, Charles Darwin. Those whom we have omitted would make as fair a list: Democritus, Epicurus, Marcus Aurelius, Abelard, Galileo, Spinoza, Leibniz, Schopenhauer, Spencer, Nietzsche. And consider the vast movements of thought which we have ignored. Feminism, for example, with its great leaders from Mary Wollstonecraft to Susan Anthony, and socialism, with its roster of hopeful theorists from Diogenes and Zeno to LaSalle and Marx. It must be so. No list could exhaust the treasure of man's heritage or equal its infinite variety. And it is well. Let us have many lists and many heroes. We cannot honor them too much or commemorate them excessively. Here, perhaps, is the true litany of saints. These are the names that should adorn our calendars, with those that gave new beauty to the world, or counseled it to a gentler humanity. Chapter 3. The 10 Greatest Poets. I dare not go on till I face the question that every logician will have asked before our quest began. What is your test of greatness in a poet? It is a sorry dilemma, for if I select some objective test, proudly independent of my personal likings and tastes, we shall lose the zest of adventure and surprise that might come from a gay surrender to individual preference. And the only objective test is fame or influence. But this criterion, which seems so plausible in choosing the greatest thinkers, breaks down in the presence of poets. Who could think of rating contemporary poets according to influence or repute? Who would name the kindly and melodious Longfellow as our greatest weaver of songs merely because greater numbers listen to him gladly than will accept the jaunty heresies and experiments of Whitman? No, let me not pretend to do more here than to reveal my prejudices, to record the men who, beyond all others, have brought me that strange mixture of music, emotion, imagery, and thought, which is poetry. Number 1. Homer. Many years ago, in Russia, I saw the origin of poetry. We had resolved to study the Russians and their homes and their natural environment, and we had settled down for a week on peasant fare and peasant boards in the izba of our guide's family in Chernigov. On the first night of our stay, the villagers looked at us with suspicion. Some timid souls announced that we had come to steal their children. But on the second night, they gathered outside our hut for an open-air frolic of music and dancing, and as we sat on benches or the uncut grass, an old man, bearded and blind, sitting against a wall, chanted to the accompaniment of his balalaika the ancient legends of his race. It was a plaintive narrative, always ending on a minor tone that invited the leisurely continuance of the tale, like some great revolving wheel whose impetus of motion repeatedly suffices to give it another turn. And as I listened, I thought I saw Homer singing to the Greeks the fall of Troy. In this simple and musical way, with rhythm aiding memory, man transmitted and ornamented his history before writing came. In the days of the gods, history was sublime enough for poetry. The story of human love and war, refulgent with heavenly interest from the participation of deities, lifted the accumulative narratives of many traveling bards into the epics that we know as the Iliad and the Odyssey. Homer was probably one of the singers who chanted these commemorative songs. We give his name to all the poets who compose these tales because we are at ease with unity and dislike the fragmentariness of truth. Every nation's literature begins with such epics, Vedas or sagas, Ramayanas, Mahabharatas, Nibelungenlieds, Beowulfs, or Chansons de Roland. They are as natural to a nation's childhood as to an individual's. They take the place of those patriotic histories in which one's country is always right, wins every battle, and is especially beloved of God. It seems unimportant and irrelevant that the tale as Homer tells it is not true, that his men and women, and even some of his deities, are apparently the creatures of his lordly imagination. It is so well invented and so vivaciously recounted that if the facts were different, so much the worse for the facts. Beauty has its rights as well as truth, and the Iliad is more important than the Trojan War. Granted that Helen was but a name or an inspiring diplomatic phrase, and that the real objective of the warring Greeks was not a lovely rake, but a strategic port, nevertheless, seven Troys lie buried in the earth, while Helen is an immortal synonym of loveliness, potent still to launch 100,000 books upon that greatest of all oceans, ink. Nor does it matter that these ancient epics are not complex in art or thought. They were addressed to the ear, not to the mind, and to the people, not to subtle lords. They had to be understood as soon as heard, and they had to be carried onward with vigorous action. Today, we lead intricate and often introverted lives, in which action, as the Greeks knew it, is a rare exception, found chiefly in the press and gathered from afar. Man is now an animal that stops and thinks. Therefore, our literature is an analysis of motives and thought. It is in mental conflict that we find the profoundest wars and the darkest tragedies. But in Homer's day, life was action, and Homer was action's prophet. His verse and style are almost dictated by action. Through his turbulent hexameters, the story runs like some broad and powerful stream, so that, when at last we have learned the genealogy of the heroes and the gods, we are caught and held by the poem as by some swift Niagara, And yet in the midst of the battles comes such quiet poetry as this, fair even in our lame rendition. Thus made harangue to them Hector, and roaring the Trojans applauded. Then from the yoke loosed their war steeds sweating, and each by his chariot tethered his horses with thongs. And then they brought from the city, hastily, oxen and goodly sheep, and wine honey-hearted.